Books on Tape presents Treason, Liberal Treachery from the Cold War to the War on Terrorism by Ann Coulter. Read by Kate Mazur. Chapter 1, 50 Years of Treason. Liberals have a preternatural gift for striking a position on the side of treason. You could be talking about Scrabble, and they would instantly leap to the anti-American position. Everyone says liberals love America too. No, they don't. Whenever the nation is under attack, from within or without, liberals side with the enemy. This is their essence. The left's obsession with the crimes of the West and their Rousseauian respect for third world savages all flow from this subversive goal. If anyone has the gaucherie to point out the left's nearly unblemished record of rooting against America, liberals turn around and scream, McCarthyism! Liberals invented the myth of McCarthyism to delegitimize impertinent questions about their own patriotism. They boast, lyingly, about their superior stance on civil rights. But somehow their loyalty to the United States is off-limits as a subject of political debate. Why is the relative patriotism of the two parties the only issue that is out of bounds for discussion? Why can't we ask, who is more patriotic, Democrats or Republicans? You could win that case in court. 50 years ago, Senator Joe McCarthy said, "The loyal Democrats of this nation no longer have a party." Since then, the evidence has continued to pour in. Liberals mock Americans who love their country, calling them cowboys, warmongers, religious zealots, and jingoists. By contrast, America's enemies are called Uncle Joe, Fidel, agrarian reformers, and practitioners of a religion of peace. Indeed, communists and terrorists alike are said to be advocates of peace. Liberals demand that the nation treat enemies like friends, and friends like enemies. We must lift sanctions, cancel embargoes, pull out our troops, reason with our adversaries, and absolutely never wage war, unless the French say it's okay. Any evidence that anyone seeks to harm America is stridently rejected as no evidence. Democratic senators, congressmen, and ex-presidents are always popping up in countries hostile to the United States. Cuba, Nicaragua, North Korea, Iraq, hobnobbing with foreign despots who hate America. 1 year after Osama bin Laden staged a massive assault on America, a Democratic senator was praising bin Laden for his good work in building daycare centers. At least we can be thankful that in the war on terrorism, we were spared the spectacle of liberals calling Osama bin Laden an agrarian reformer. The ACLU responded to the 9/11 terrorist attack by threatening to sue schools that hung God Bless America signs. Is the ACLU more or less patriotic than the Daughters of the American Revolution? Public schools across the nation prohibited the saying of the Pledge of Allegiance. Is it more patriotic or less patriotic to prevent school children from saying the Pledge of Allegiance? University professors called patriotic Americans naive and described patriotism as a benign umbrella for angry people. Is it more patriotic to love your country or to ridicule those who do as naive and angry? These are not questions impenetrable to human logic. Liberals want to attack America without anyone making an issue of it. Patriotism is vitally important, but somehow impossible to measure. Liberals relentlessly oppose the military, the Pledge of Allegiance, the flag, and national defense. But if anyone calls them on it, they say he's a kook and a nut. Citing the unpatriotic positions of liberals constitutes McCarthyism. In the 1988 presidential campaign, Vice President George Bush pointed out that his opponent, Michael Dukakis, had vetoed a bill requiring students to begin their day with the Pledge of Allegiance. Liberals' heads spun with the dark reminders of the McCarthy era. Dukakis instantly compared Bush's dastardly trick of citing his record to Senator Joseph McCarthy's red-baiting during the 1950s. Despite this slur against his patriotism, Dukakis said, "The American people can smell the garbage." At least sophisticated Americans could smell the garbage. As one journalist said of Bush's unwarranted reference to Dukakis's record, it was intended to rile up ignoramuses in the American populace, the folks who don't know any better, whose inferior education or experience has not taught them that the right to speak out is the rudder of this great big boat we call America. The only people whose right to speak out is not part of this great big boat we call America are Republicans, who dare to mention that a Democrat vetoed the Pledge of Allegiance. Free speech is a one-way ratchet for traitors. While journalists assailed Bush for creating an atmosphere of intolerance for those who object to patriotic oaths, they didn't mind creating an atmosphere of intolerance towards those who support patriotic oaths. Later, while campaigning at a naval base, Bush said of Dukakis, "I wouldn't be surprised if he thinks a naval exercise is something you find in the Jane Fonda workout book." Again, there were wails of McCarthyism all around. Showing the left's renowned ability to get a joke, one reporter earnestly demanded to know, "Did Bush mean to imply that Dukakis is anti-military?" Bush responded to the hysteria over his Jane Fonda joke, saying, "Was that funny? Reasonably funny? A naval exercise. I thought that was pretty funny." Historians claimed they had not seen patriotism used with such cynical force since the 50s. It was disturbing, historians and political analysts said, for Bush to manipulate symbols to raise doubts about the Democratic nominee's patriotism. Historian William Luchtenberger at the University of North Carolina said, "I don't recall anything like this before. I don't think there has been an issue like this, an issue so irrelevant to the powers of the presidency." Washington Post columnist Mary McGrory complained about the McCarthy-esque form to Bush's language. "The subliminal message in all the nastiness and bad taste is that Dukakis is somehow un-American, doesn't salute the flag or dig defense." The New York Times denounced Bush for wrapping himself in the flag. Through his masterly use of the subliminal, Bush had used political code. The code was pledge plus flag plus strong defense equals patriotism. Evidently, true patriotism consists of hatred of flag plus hatred of pledge plus weakness on national defense. Not going for subtlety, this was under the headline, "Playing Rough, Campaign Takes a Turn on the Low Road." A frenzy of McCarthyism arose again in Bush's next presidential campaign against noted patriot Bill Clinton. While a Rhodes Scholar, Clinton joined anti-war protests abroad. 1 year after the USSR crushed Czechoslovakia, Clinton had taken what the media called a sightseeing trip to Moscow. For mentioning Clinton's anti-war protests abroad, Bush was called a nut and a McCarthyite. Clinton campaign aide George Stephanopoulos said Bush was off the wall, lost his compass. Clinton's running mate, Al Gore, accused Bush of smear tactics, McCarthyite techniques. Meanwhile, CNN's Robert Novak defended McCarthy, saying, "Joe didn't do any innuendo. Joe would have said, the guy is a communist." McCarthyism means pointing out positions taken by liberals that are unpopular with the American people. As former President Bush said, "Liberals do not like me talking about liberals." The reason they sob about the dark night of fascism under McCarthy is to prevent Americans from ever noticing that liberals consistently attack their own country. Liberals unreservedly call all conservatives fascists, racists, and enemies of civil liberties with no facts whatsoever. Reviewing the movie 8 Mile in The New Yorker, David Denby praised the interracial friendships portrayed in the movie and then said, Perhaps the specter of such friendships is what right-wingers actually hate most. Conservatives are prohibited from citing actual facts that reflect poorly on a Democrat's patriotism, but liberals regularly fire off shots like that from their little movie reviews. Liberals malign the flag, ban the pledge, and hold cocktail parties for America's enemies, but no one is ever allowed to cast the slightest aspersion on their patriotism. The very same article that attacked Bush for questioning Dukakis' patriotism questioned Bush's sensitivity to civil rights for mentioning Dukakis' veto of the pledge. The writer scoffed. George Bush will really be a stand-up guy when it comes to civil liberties. You betcha. We could draw no conclusions from Dukakis' veto of the pledge. It was a smear merely to state the implacable fact that Dukakis had vetoed the Pledge of Allegiance. But apparently, it was not a smear to attack Bush's stand on civil liberties for mentioning Dukakis' veto of the pledge. Only questions about patriotism are disallowed, unless it is to say that liberals are the real patriots. Phil Donahue said the real patriots were people who aggressively opposed their own country's war plans. Are the protesters the real patriots? It is at least counterintuitive to say that it is more patriotic to attack America than to defend it. Even Donahue couldn't continue with such absurd logic and quickly condemned patriotism as the last refuge of scoundrels and warned, beware of patriotism. In addition to opposing any action taken by your own country, real patriotism also consists of promoting the liberal agenda. After 9/11, Mario Cuomo said real patriotism consisted of fighting the war on poverty. Liberal columnist David Broder said real patriotism consisted of expanding the Peace Corps and Clinton's worthless AmeriCorps. A writer for the Kansas City Star, Bill Timaeus, said real patriots support education, especially the public schools. The only unpatriotic act he identified was trying to silence dissident voices. A man protesting the Pledge of Allegiance in public schools said, "True Americans separate church and state." A woman opposing the pledge said, "Real patriotism and real love for your country is dissent or people fighting against the closure of hospitals." Liberals don't mind discussing who is more patriotic if patriotism is defined as redistributing income and vetoing the Pledge of Allegiance. Only if patriotism is defined as supporting America do they get testy and drone on about McCarthyism. In June 2002, an American-born Muslim named Abdullah al-Mujahir was arrested on charges of trying to build a dirty bomb. Most Americans were worried about a terrorist taking out Lower Manhattan, but the New York Times was worried about an outbreak of McCarthyism. According to the Times, the arrest reminded many people of McCarthyism and of zealous FBI agents defining the limits of political orthodoxy. Al-Mujahir's arrest had revived a fear that has permeated popular history that a homegrown fifth column is betraying fellow Americans on behalf of a foreign foe. Historian Richard Hofstadter diagnosed the country's attempts at self-preservation as a form of political paranoia. Even Benedict Arnold was thrown into the Times' enumeration of victims of America's paranoia, raising the question, is there no traitor liberals won't defend? Liberals attack their country and then go into diarrhea panic if anyone criticizes them. Days after 9/11, as the corpses of thousands of our fellow countrymen lay in smoldering heaps in the wreckage of the World Trade Center, Professor Eric Foner of Columbia University said, "I'm not sure which is more frightening, the horror that engulfed New York City or the apocalyptic rhetoric emanating daily from the White House." On the basis of exhaustive research, apparently the events of September 11th, including the wanton slaughter of 3,000 Americans, were worse than Bush's rhetoric, frightening and disturbing though it may be. Whenever a liberal begins a statement with, "I don't know which is more frightening," you know the answer is going to be pretty clear. Foner claimed to be the victim of McCarthyite tactics for not being lavished with praise for his idiotic remark. A report by the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, founded by Lynn Cheney and Senator Joseph Lieberman, cited Foner's remark as an example of how universities were failing America. This was, Foner said, analogous to McCarthyism. These self-appointed guardians were engaging in private blacklisting and trying to intimidate individuals who hold different points of view. A private group issuing a report criticizing him was disturbing and a cause for considerable alarm. The eminent historian Ronald Radish is blacklisted from every university in the nation because he wrote the book definitively proving the guilt of executed spies Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. But if someone fails to agree with tenured Columbia professor Foner, he screams he is being intimidated. There aren't loyalty oaths being demanded of teachers yet, Foner said, but we seem to be at the beginning of a process that could get a lot worse. If Eric Foner wants to claim he is patriotic, why doesn't he have to do something to show he supports America someday? Why is it assumed that patriotism is an unmeasurable quality? Is Eric Foner more or less patriotic than Irving Berlin? Berlin wrote the great patriotic song, God Bless America. He donated all profits from the song in perpetuity to the Boy Scouts of America, an organization so patriotic it removed President Clinton as honorary president. Berlin served in World War I and entertained the troops in World War II with a play he wrote for the troops, This is the Army. He greeted prisoners of war returning from Vietnam at the White House, playing God Bless America. If only Berlin were around today, he could write us a new song for the war on terrorism, something like, Goodbye, Walla Walla, I'm off to smash Allah. Meanwhile, Foner compared the malevolent terror of Islamic terrorists to rhetoric from President Bush. He defended Soviet atrocities. He is still defending proven Soviet spy Julius Rosenberg. If only Foner could see beyond what is bad for the United States, he might see that fighting terrorism and communism might be good for people of other nations, too. In a long tradition of patriotism, in 1941, Foner's father was fired from his job as a state college teacher under the New York state law that prohibited state-supported teachers from engaging in seditious or treasonous speech. Inasmuch as this happened in New York State, while Joe McCarthy was still a young circuit court judge in Wisconsin, the New York Times referred to Foner's firing as a pre-McCarthy Red Scare. Isn't someone who opposes his own country less patriotic than someone who loves his country? While constantly rooting against America, liberals have used a fictional event forged of their own hysteria, McCarthyism, to prevent Americans from ever asking the simple question, do liberals love their country? In McCarthy's day, a battle against communism hung in the balance even more than the battle against terrorism hangs in the balance today. Time and again, in all crucial matters of national defense, the Democratic Party has shirked the honor of leading this country in war, be it cold or hot. Such a party must not be allowed in the Oval Office. That was McCarthy's central point a half century ago, and it's even more obvious today. America's enemies change, but the treason remains the same. A full accounting of the left's perfidy throughout the second half of the 20th century is incalculable. Will and Ariel Durant could not document it. Story of Civilization, 11 volumes. But it is impossible to understand their naysaying in the war on terrorism today, their vicious wrath, and even their maniacal defense of Bill Clinton, without a brief review of their treachery at the onset of the Cold War. In the early 50s, ex-communist Whitaker Chambers said, "In this century, within the next decades, it will be decided for generations whether all mankind is to become communist, whether the whole world is to become free, or whether, in the struggle, civilization as we know it is to be completely destroyed. It had been his fate, he said, to have been, in turn, a witness to each of the two great faiths of our time, God and communism. Communism, he said, is the vision of man without God. It was man's second oldest faith. Its promise was whispered in the first days of the creation under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, ye shall be as gods. These were the irreconcilable opposites, God or man, soul or mind, freedom or communism. Liberals chose man. Conservatives chose God. The struggle between the two great faiths was the subtext of every great political conflict in America in the second half of the 20th century. It was this conflict that fueled the Chamber's Hiss hearings. McCarthyism, Vietnam, Watergate, and the elite's abiding hatred for Ronald Reagan. At the end of the century, and against the odds, the free world won. It was a crushing defeat for liberals. Not because liberals were necessarily communists, though many were, but because they had been morally blind to communism. Democratic administrations contained archipelagos of communist spies, but Democrats had never, not once, responded with genuine anger to Soviet espionage. Liberal elites defended traitors. In response to the Soviet threat, the Democrats consistently counseled defeat, supplication, and retreat. Indeed, they spent most of the Cold War jeering at phrases like Soviet threat. They said communist advances were inevitable, and communist dictators were agrarian reformers. No one lost China. Détente, not victory, was the best the free world could hope for. Phrases like captive nations and freedom fighters were invariably put in derisive quotes. As long as the Soviet Union thrived, the inevitability argument fell within the range of patriotic behavior. If Soviet domination really was inevitable, liberals were just being brutally frank messengers. But then, Reagan won the Cold War. It turned out communism's triumph wasn't inevitable after all. The left's teleological argument for communist domination was a lie. Liberals were either dupes or traitors in the greatest battle of the 20th century. In his own way, Nixon was as crucial as Reagan in defeating Soviet communism. Nixon exposed the Truman and Roosevelt administrations as having appointed known saboteur Alger Hiss to positions of influence within the government. The Hiss case marked the point at which liberals became conscious of themselves as a conspiracy. There was no turning back. Nixon showed the American people that liberals had failed to meet the challenge of communist espionage in the highest reaches of government. No matter how many Harvard men spoke on Hiss's behalf, liberals could not stave off the moment of truth. Naturally, therefore, they engaged in lying to ward off Nixon's exposure of Hiss, just as they would again a half century later to save Clinton. The Republican Party would fail to meet other challenges. There was a reason for liberal political hegemony in the decades preceding the Hiss affair, but with the Hiss case, Nixon created a new universe. He had exposed liberals as dupes of totalitarianism. The Democratic Party could never be trusted again in the same way. Democrats and Republicans ceased being viewed as uniformly American. For this, liberals would never forgive Nixon. Watergate would be the left's ultimate revenge against him for telling the truth about Hiss. To rehabilitate Hiss, they would destroy Nixon. As the New York Times put it in Hiss's obituary, Hiss's reputation seemed to wax and wane with each new turn in the fortunes of Mr. Nixon. While reacting with unblinking ennui to Soviet spies in high government office, Democrats engaged in drama queen theatrics over McCarthyism. The myth of McCarthyism is the greatest Orwellian fraud of our times. The portrayal of Senator Joe McCarthy as a wild-eyed demagogue destroying innocent lives is sheer liberal hobgoblinism. Liberals weren't cowering in fear during the McCarthy era. They were systematically undermining the nation's ability to defend itself while waging a bellicose campaign of lies to blacken McCarthy's name. Everything you think you know about McCarthy is a hegemonic lie. Liberals denounced McCarthy because they were afraid of getting caught, so they fought back like animals to hide their own collaboration with a regime as evil as the Nazis. They scream about the dark night of fascism under McCarthy to prevent Americans from ever noticing that liberals sabotaged their own country. As Whitaker Chambers said, innocence seldom utters outraged shrieks. Guilt does. At the time, everyone knew liberals were lying. But after a half century of liberal myth-making, it would be Judgment Day for liberals on July 11, 1995. On that day, the U.S. government released a cache of Soviet cables that had been decoded during the Cold War in a top-secret undertaking known as the Venona Project. The cables proved the overwhelming truth of McCarthy's charges. It was a mind-boggling discovery. Professors would be forced to retract their theses about the extent of Soviet espionage. Alger Hiss, Julius Rosenberg, even American journalist I.F. Stone were exposed as agents of Moscow. And yet, most people reading this book are hearing about the Venona Project for the very first time. The release of decrypted Soviet cables was barely mentioned by the New York Times. It might have detracted from stories of proud and unbowed victims of McCarthyism. They were not so innocent after all, it turns out. Soviet spies in the government were not a figment of right-wing imaginations. McCarthy was not tilting at windmills. He was tilting at an authentic communist conspiracy that had been laughed off by the Democratic Party. The Democrats had unpardonably connived with one of the greatest evils of the 20th century. This could not be nullified. But liberals could at least hope to redeem the Democratic Party by dedicating themselves to rewriting history and blackening reputations. This is what they had done repeatedly throughout the Cold War. At every strategic moment this century, liberals would wage a campaign of horrendous lies and disinformation to dull the discovery that the American people had made. They had gotten good at it. There were, admittedly, a few rare and striking exceptions to the left's overall obtuseness to communist totalitarianism. The Democratic Party was certainly more patriotic then than it has become. Throughout the 60s, the Democrats could still produce the occasional Scoop Jackson Democrat. John F. Kennedy's pronouncements on communism could have been spoken by Joe McCarthy. His brother Robert worked for McCarthy. For all his flaws, President Harry Truman was a completely different breed from today's Democrats. He unquestionably loved his country. Through the years, there were various epiphanic moments creating yet more anti-communist Democrats. The Stalin-Hitler Pact, Hiss's Prothonotary Warbler, Stalin's Show Trials, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago, all these had their effect. But after World War II, the Democratic Party suffered from the sort of pusillanimous psychosis that seized all of France after World War I. The entire party began to lose its nerve for sacrifice, heroism, and bravery. Beginning in the 50s, there was a real fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. By the late 60s, the contest was over. The anti-communist Democrats had lost. In 1972, George McGovern, darling of left-wing radicals, was the Democratic presidential candidate. SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, leader, and Chicago riot instigator Tom Hayden became a Democratic state senator in California. In 1968, Staunton Lind said of Tom Hayden, "On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, he was a National Liberation Front guerrilla, and on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, he was on the left wing of the Democratic Party." Black Panther Bobby Rush would go on to become a Democratic congressman. Todd Gitlin, a former president of SDS, would soon be a university professor and frequent op-ed columnist for the New York Times. This was the new Democratic Party. By the time of the 1991 Gulf War, only 10 Senate Democrats voted with President Bush to use troops against Saddam Hussein. If the old Democratic Party was merely obtuse, the new Democratic Party was a beachhead of domestic anti-Americanism. Clinton was the left's last best hope for proving they could, too, handle the presidency. Having tricked the American people into entrusting a Democrat with the White House on a bare plurality vote, they had to defend him from any lie, any felony, any reprehensible, contemptible conduct he threw their way. When Clinton first showed his fat, oleaginous mug to the nation, the Republicans screamed he was a draft-dodging, pot-smoking, flim-flam artist. Had the Republicans turned out to be right again, it would have sounded the death knell for the Democratic Party. So the Democrats lied. Through their infernal politics of personal destruction, liberals stayed in the game for a few more years. Unless we fight for proper treatment of history and counter the nonsense images of McCarthy, no history can be safe from the liberal noise machine. School children will be taught that all of America cringed with terror at Ken Starr, whose evil designs on the nation were frustrated only through the sacrifice of brave liberals. People will have vivid images of the pounding boots of Starr's subpoena servers and the Gestapo-like wails of alarms as Ken Starr arrived to kick in the doors of innocent Americans and storm through their bedrooms. It will be the reign of terror under Ken Starr. Bill Clinton will be revered in history books as the George Washington of his day, who, along with patriots Larry Flint and James Carville, saved the Constitution. He will be honored with a memorial larger than the Washington Monument, though probably with the same general design. People will believe that, and liberals will continue unabashedly invoking a lie in order to shield their ongoing traitorous behavior. The credibility of Democrats on national defense is now at stake as it has not been since McCarthy's day. Democrats are on the precipice of securing their reputation as the Chamberlains of our time. In fact, today's appeasers are worse than Neville Chamberlain. Chamberlain didn't have himself as an example. In the latest round of liberal demoralization techniques, they are once again rooting against America. You would think the most destructive terrorist attack in the history of the world would call for something new. But liberals have simply dusted off the old clichés from the Cold War and trotted them out for the war on terrorism. The only patriotic liberal in the world is Tony Blair, and he's in England. Every once in a while, their tempers get the best of them, and like Dr. Strangelove trying to restrain the Nazi salute, liberals say what they really mean. Their own words damn them as hating America. 1 week before the first anniversary of 9/11, Reuters ran a photo of Ground Zero with a caption that said, "Human rights around the world have been a casualty of the U.S. war on terror since September 11th. Arguably, thousands of Americans dying hideous deaths is a more comment-worthy casualty than any alleged death of human rights around the world. Also, was it really necessary to put war on terror in quotation marks? As the country was beginning to contemplate war with Iraq in the summer of 2002, a Hollywood cast of mostly has-beens and never-beens, calling their cause "Not in Our Name," issued a statement imploring all Americans to resist the war and repression that has been loosed on the world by the Bush administration. America's war on terrorism, they said, was unjust, immoral, and illegitimate. The devastation of September 11th was dismissively compared to similar scenes in Baghdad, Panama City, and a generation ago, Vietnam. Among the signers were Hanoi Jane Fonda, Ed Asner, Susan Sarandon, Casey Kasem, Noam Chomsky, Gore Vidal, Edward Said, Ben and Jerry's Ben Cohen, Kurt Vonnegut, and noted cop killer Mumia Abu-Jamal. It was a group nearly indistinguishable from those who had enthusiastically backed the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Liberals spent most of the war on terrorism in a funk because they didn't have enough grist for the anti-war mill. They nearly went stark raving mad at having to mouth patriotic platitudes while burning with a desire to aid the enemy. Having to suppress their glee at possible failure, they posted droll, rambling narratives with no apparent point on the nation's op-ed pages. Liberals write essays like little kids making up a melody. They meander along, issuing contradictory, snide remarks about Bush until they run out of energy and finally conclude with some incongruous, throaty peroration. Is fighting terrorism worth tearing up the Constitution? And boo-hoo-hoo, we have to get the French on board. Just as liberals went into a panic when Ronald Reagan referred to Russia as an evil empire, they were in a state of frenzy over Bush's axis of evil speech. If liberals were half as indignant about Osama bin Laden as they were about President Bush, their objections might rate more with real Americans. When the Democrats' bluff was called in a roll call vote in Congress, many voted for war with Iraq, inadvertently performing a great service. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd revealed the Democrats' treasonous calculations. She explained that Democrats would be forced to fake enthusiasm for the war on terror or lose the American people forever. Democrats, she said, fear that if they approach Iraq the same way they did during the Gulf War in 1991, they will be portrayed as McGovernite wimps. Consequently, liberals would lie and pretend to support America. With their votes duly recorded, they went right back to attacking the war. But why were they against it? Saddam Hussein was a madman, developing weapons of mass destruction, stewing in the same swamp as the 9/11 terrorists. We could beat him. Why were the Democrats against doing that? What do liberals want? Freud would have gone crazy with these people. Figuring out what women want is easy compared to liberals. The only two living former Democratic presidents publicly opposed the Bush administration's plan to invade Iraq. Jimmy Carter couldn't land a helicopter in the desert, but he seemed to imagine the public was hungry for his counsel in the war on terrorism. Carter is so often maligned for his stupidity, it tends to be forgotten that he is also self-righteous, vengeful, sneaky, and backstabbing. In a vituperative piece in the Washington Post, Carter peremptorily announced, "There is no current danger to the United States from Baghdad. The real threat to world peace and global human rights," he said, "came from President Bush." The Bush administration, with its belligerent and divisive voices, was becoming similar to those of abusive regimes that historically have been condemned by American presidents. This for incarcerating members of Al-Qaeda at Guantanamo without regulation tennis courts. The only subject fewer authentic Americans cared about than the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo was World Cup soccer. America is in an epic global battle with ruthless savages who seek our destruction, and liberals are feeling sorry for the terrorists. Unlike the belligerent and divisive voices here in America, Carter believed that the great statesman Saddam Hussein could be reasoned with, despite the fact that Hussein was a habitual liar and cold-blooded murderer. But surely Saddam would realize, Carter said, that actually using a weapon of mass destruction would be suicidal. Unless, of course, a Democrat were in the White House, in which case Saddam could rest assured that there would be no belligerent and divisive voices to counsel retaliation. Bill Clinton, who bombed an aspirin factory in the Sudan to distract from the investigation of his criminal offenses at home, also had a lot of advice for President Bush. The impeached former president unleashed the canard about having to get Osama bin Laden first, as if there could ever be sufficient predicates for a Democrat to support their own country in war. Saddam Hussein didn't kill 3,100 people on September 11th, Clinton said. Osama bin Laden did, and as far as we know, he's still alive. This came roughly 1 month after Clinton suggested that resources being used to pursue Osama bin Laden could be better spent combating AIDS. Clinton had proposed that the country spend another $1.5 billion fighting AIDS, which was, he pointedly noted, less than 2 months of the Afghan war, and less than 2% of the requested increases for defense in America. So first we abolish AIDS, then we produce Osama's DNA, and then the time will be ripe to take out a madman who longs to annihilate Americans. Liberals' attitude toward a swamp is that we have to go around killing mosquitoes individually only after proving the targeted mosquito is about to bite us. Otherwise, we might make the mosquitoes mad. Whatever the left's last-minute hawkishness, all their behavior is calculated to demoralize Americans and to suppress anger. Liberals' principal contribution to the war on terrorism has been to bill themselves as a corrective to jingoism. Their real goal is too appalling to state out loud. Whether they are defending the Soviet Union or bleating for Saddam Hussein, liberals are always against America. They are either traitors or idiots. And on the matter of America's self-preservation, the difference is irrelevant. 50 years of treason hasn't slowed them down.